Good evening. It's Sunday, March 7th, 2021. I'm Sharon Sabota, and I'll be with you for the next hour on this eve of International Women's Day for some special International Women's Day programming. As the pandemic has imposed physical isolation on many of us, women around the world are finding that we're even more connected than we imagined. Coming up in the first hour, Women in the Pandemic, as farmers across India fight for their rights, where do women fit into the food justice movement?
I'm a daughter of farmers. I'm a granddaughter of farmers, and we till the soil. So we all got green thumbs, whether we want to admit it or not. But I think this movement in particular, the women are not the cattle being led. They are the catalyst leading.
How are educators, care providers, and parents pivoting to meet children where they're at during these pandemic times?
I have been home with my kids for that March through July time. I was home with them the entirety of that time and trying to get my own work done. But, you know, there's a pile of laundry over there, so that has to get done. They have to be fed. They have to, someone has to follow up on homework, and that all falls on mom.
And what happens when you find your true gender identity in your 60s?
I'm in my third year of transition. I came out August of 2018, and I first started questioning or experimenting when I was 63. It took me a full year to wrestle with myself. Tell you the truth, I didn't even know what trans was. I mean, wasn't even on the radar.
In the second half of the show, Silent No More.
I could hear my heart in my ears. I was cold and shaking, but yet sweating. And then I could hear his zipper on his pants. And then he stopped, and I heard like this button and stuff like that. And I looked, and he set his gun down on the dash, and it was pointed right at me.
Decades after being assaulted, stalked, and taunted by a police officer in the small town of Whitehall, Wisconsin, a woman who we'll call June tells us how she's confronted years of intergenerational trauma and struggle to transition from victim to survivor.
If I can help other people find their voice and I can help other people feel strong, then I will continue to get my strength and I will continue to have my voice. And that can't be taken from me anymore. And that can't be silenced anymore.
I'm Sharon Sabota, and you're listening to special International Women's Day programming on KPFA 94.1 FM and online at kpfa.org. Indian farmers have been protesting for months after Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi announced his plans to privatize India's agricultural system. Daljeet Kaurasani is a labor and employment civil rights attorney. I spoke with her to get a better understanding of where women fit into the food justice movement.
80% of the farm work that's done in India is done by women, but they own 12% of the land. And so we see the remnants of patriarchal traditions show up in property ownership. And these women are harvesting, sowing the seeds. They're doing every stage of the process of growing crops. They're there. And sometimes they're there alone because farmers commit suicide every 30 minutes. That's 10,000 a year. And so these women are left to not only manage the farms if they are of the farm owning type. And these are not large farms. These are on average 1 to 5, 1 to 2 acres. And so they're left to manage not only the crops and the machinery, the debts, but also raising children alone. And the images from the amazing photographers that are on the ground are really heart-wrenching because you see just a sea of yellow chunnis, which are headscarves, and the women are holding the pictures of their fathers and their sons that have died.
For Kaurasani, the food justice movement and farmer strike in India is personal.
I'm a daughter of farmers. I'm a granddaughter of farmers, and we till the soil. So we all got green thumbs, whether we want to admit it or not. But I think this movement in particular, the women are not the cattle being led. They are the catalyst leading. And we see that with the BKU, the Bharatiya Kisan Union. There's a woman named Harjinder Kaur Bindu. She's president from Bathinda, which is a region of Punjab popular for its cotton resources. And in her local union, she has 30,000 women. And a lot of these women become widows. And so she has dealt directly with the impact of farmer suicides, which is a direct result of the Green Revolution.
And what did the Green Revolution mean in India?
those policies that promoted the use of hybrid monoculture seeds really destroyed the climate, the land. Punjab is going to become a desert very soon. Those policies that were promoted by the Rockefeller Foundation, the Ford Foundation, with the encouragement of the United States, really manipulated the biodiversity and the agroecology of not just India, but Mexico as well.
Kurasani says the proposed agricultural laws in India are nuanced. And while the government may describe them as a way to garner free market access, Kurasani says it's important to ask who will have that access.
What these laws do will remove the price floor and allow the farmers to sell their crops anywhere in India. But most of these low-income workers are not going to have the scale of operation to be able to sell their wheat to Maharashtra or Sri Lanka or whatever. So it's touted as, oh, this is market efficiency and you'll have access to a greater market, but access for who? We also know from research that the organization Grain has done that this is a merger of big tech and big ag. $28 billion has been invested from foreign governments, mostly the United States and the UK, to invest into this agriculture new world. India also is coveted by these billionaires because the online retail market is open and vulnerable, but that's only going to benefit the educated elite. The large rural population is not going to benefit from Amazon Prime.
As farmers from the states of Punjab and Haryana have led the protests on the outskirts of Delhi, Kurasani says the intersections of xenophobia and sexism have become even more apparent.
The mayhem surrounding what was supposed to be a peaceful tractor parade, we saw what's at stake because there was the group of tents that had women in it that were, I think, sleeping. It was nighttime. And Ranjit Singh, when he saw that this mob was approaching the women's tent, he came out to defend them and was brutally attacked. They took off his turban, they removed his clothing, and he's still in jail. There's no medical report. And I saw that on video and I was so triggered.
For Kurasani, being involved with the Indian farmer strike brings her activism full circle.
I'm re-triggered as someone who's 4 years old protesting against the Indian embassy. That was my first protest. That was my, that was my activism being born in front of the Indian embassy in San Francisco. And then I'm 40 years old in November last year, doing this again, protesting before the Indian embassy in Washington, D.C. Like, when is this going to stop?
And now as a mom of three, Kurasani says the same thing that keeps her grounded and living in the present is what keeps her fighting for change.
I think it's the next generation. And it's the same thing that you hear our buzurg, which means elderly in Punjabi. You hear them say that as well. People ask them, why are you protesting? You know, you need blood pressure medicine, or you're on a catheter. You can barely walk. Like, why are you here? Why are you suffering like this? And they say, we're connected to the land. And so if these laws continue, that's our death. So why not stay here until death? Because that's how much the land means to us. And that I derive strength from that and from knowing that my daughters are watching this from a distance. They may not understand exactly what's going on, but they see the rise and fall of my emotions. And yesterday, my daughter drew a picture for the protesters and she gave me a prayer stick when I picked her up from daycare. And she said, Mommy, can you give this to the protesters? And so I think that it makes an impact. And we're trying to help foster stewards of the earth. And so when we make the connections between a farmer's movement to climate justice, to women's rights, to racial justice, to caste equity, then we leave a template that the next generation can follow.
To learn more about how to support farmers in India, you can visit wesupportfarmers.org. As journalist Elaine Woltereth has said, sometimes just being yourself is the radical act. When you occupy space in systems that weren't built for you, your authenticity is your activism. This quote is something that our next guest, Diara Reed, resonates with.
I'm in my third year of transition. I came out August of 2018.
As Betty Reed Soskin, the oldest park ranger in the United States, and likely the world, has been making her mark on the world in her golden years, her daughter Diara Reed has been on a journey of her own.
I first started questioning or experimenting when I was 63. It took me a full year to wrestle with myself. And tell you the truth, I didn't even know what trans was. I mean, wasn't even on the radar.
After fathering four biological children and three stepchildren, Diara Reed embarked on a gender identity journey with the vision of finding her true self.
I was following in my father's footsteps and how a man is supposed to be. And I struggled through, you know, three relationships, two marriages. Most of my adult life was parenting. That came first. My needs weren't even on the table. So it wasn't even an issue to even think about. I mean, it would come up, but it would, you know, just, hey, I got this to do. I got that to do. I got this. I got Little League. I got work. I got, you know, all these things to do. So when I turned 63, I had ended a relationship with this woman that I had been involved with for 15 years. And my youngest two daughters were like, I think, 18 and 20. And my 20-year-old was down in college down in Irvine. So, you know, my other two kids were like, you know, at that point, I think like 27 and 35. They didn't need me anymore. They didn't even want me around anymore. So now it's like, I can turn attention to me since I was early 20s, you know? I mean, the first time.
Reed said she considered waiting until she closed the record store in Berkeley where she sold gospel music before transitioning. But in the end, she said she couldn't wait to get back to her true self.
My plan was to wait until I closed in 2019 and then I could go transition off on my own. I didn't make it to October 2018 and I was dressed full time every day down in the store. You don't know how people are going to react. And in my groups, most of the women there don't even talk with their families anymore. You know, I mean, they've been rejected. And I'm like, oh my God. You know, what am I doing? Is this selfish? Am I going to ruin my relationship with my kids, my mom, my brother, the world, you know, my business, everything. And things turned out all right.
Reed says she's far less afraid of marginalization than many of the people in her support groups.
The 3 years I've been in these groups, I hear over and over the grieving of losing male privilege. And I'm kind of like, welcome to my neighborhood. You're black now. You know, I mean, this is my life. You know, I mean, I've been marginalized all my life. Maybe I'm marginalized more, but it's like I'm familiar with the territory.
Once Reed came to full terms with who she was, she had the daunting task of sharing the news with her children, her siblings, and of course, her mother.
So since I told her, she was like, I'm going to love you either way. But she had no idea what trans was. She's doing well now, but she grieved for her son. She had her son for 63 years, and who is this person? So she couldn't, you know, she couldn't see Diara. She just saw David dressed up as a woman. It's one thing to intellectualize the whole thing and put it in its proper place. It's another thing to actually do the do. So it's taken her some time, and I think she now sees me.
After Diara's mother, Betty Reed Soskin, who's now 99 years old, experienced a major health scare, Diara became her full-time caretaker.
Having to take care of my mother or a parent in their waning years has always terrified me. And to tell you the truth, David was scared. I'm not sure if David had the capacity to deal with it, but it's not a thing for Diara. Diara has so much more capacity than David did, so much more empathy than David.
So what does caretaking look like for you on an average day?
If you know my mom, she likes her space. So, you know, she doesn't want too much help. I think mostly, you know, running the household, making sure she eats, making sure she remembers her meds, make sure everything's there, what she needs is there. She knows that somebody's here. It doesn't necessarily have to be on top of her, but, you know, she knows I'm in the apartment. She's not fearful that if something should happen, she's by herself.
That's Deara Reed speaking about her gender identity journey.
Hi, I'm Espy.
I'm Delilah.
You're listening to an International Women's Day special with Sharon Sabota on KPFA 94.1 and online at kpfa.org. Stay tuned.
That's what it sounds like in Maiva Capozzi's makeshift music studio in her garage. Capozzi offered after-school enrichment programs on elementary school campuses in the East Bay in pre-pandemic times, and then had to pivot.
Well, at first, when the quarantine started in March of 2020, I was only able to see children on Zoom, and the group classes were not successful that way. I was able to keep my business somewhat running through private voice lessons. But as soon as they loosened the restrictions in June, I created an outdoor studio and brought my very popular school class, elementary school class called Glee Club, into my outdoor studio. And it is behind my house in my garage. but the classes are held outdoors and children are able to keep at a safe distance, and they also wear masks and have protective face shields. And it's been a huge outlet for the kids, considering I noticed a huge decline in the morale of my own children and the students that I have. They were depressed, and once I started the outdoor classes and they were able to socialize, things got a lot better.
Capozzi says music classes have been as much of a morale booster for herself as they have been for the kids she teaches.
These kids, you just can't help being happy. They're funny. They laugh. We play games. They sing. Singing, to me, is just sort of a happy activity. So I feel like the silver lining, as far as for me personally, has been to improve my mood and to come out of my depression caused by the pandemic. And also, I feel like with the children, their opportunity to be able to strengthen their confidence, improving their singing and performing, even if it's performance just for their parents or for their peers, that's helped them. And it's really brought joy for me to see lots of kids come out of their shells and experience a lot of self-confidence.
And just to paint a picture for our listeners, we're standing really in the outdoor studio, which is like a section of the driveway, and there's some chairs spread out. We hear some hammering in the background, and the kids are starting to trickle in. What have you enjoyed about the outdoor lessons?
I love teaching outdoors, and I don't think I'm ever going to go back teaching indoors at this point, even at the schools, because the children have room to run, to play, and to sing.
Like many women, Capozzi's identity shifted when she became a mother.
I studied music in college. That was my major. And I had sung professionally up until I started having kids. And then when my children started singing, I started training them.
What is the most important thing that you've learned as a woman who's a mother of four children, also had another identity before being a parent, which was to be a performer, and now you're helping empower other people. So what's the most important lesson you've learned on that journey?
To follow your dreams and to keep arts in your life.
Now two of Capozzi's own teenage children, Gianna and Lucia, help her teach class.
Being at home is really hard, especially for what I like to do, which is like sing and dance and perform in shows, because like a lot of the theaters are shut down, but I really enjoy teaching with my mom because she's found a way to keep the arts alive, and it's really fun for the kids and fun for us as well.
How has art changed your life?
It has changed my life immensely. Without art, I've always been singing ever since I could talk. Without the arts in my life, I really think I would be a completely different person.
They just always bring a smile to your face. They're always in such a great mood, and they always, they just like have no filter, so it's just so fun being around them.
To learn more about Maiva Capozzi's programs, you can visit mcvt.online. Lorena Villafan Perez lives in Contra Costa County with her husband and three children and works as a family advocate for the YMCA Head Start program in Alameda County, where she supports children of low income and marginalized families.
We were absolutely closed from March until July. And during that time, as you can imagine, it was very challenging for a lot of our families. We kept in close contact with all 68 families. We did what we could to support them during the pandemic. We did some diaper giveaways. We hooked up with organizations that provided meals for our families. So we had like meal pickup days. We had partnerships with the Berkeley Food a network, and we also provided, you know, just bags of groceries for all of our families and had pickup days.
Villafan Perez says it's challenging to support already vulnerable families during pandemic times.
A lot of families couldn't afford to pay their rent. A lot of families left the area altogether. We have a lot of families who work in the food service industry. House cleaning, all of that stuff came to a halt, and it was really hard.
Now, about half of the 68 children have returned to in-person care, and the other half are still waiting to return.
The families had to do what they could, so they trusted us with their kids, and, you know, luckily we're able to provide a pretty safe environment for them. In terms of the families who were not essential working families, they're still struggling at home. I'm sure they are. We still provide diapers for the families. We still provide food for them, but they're still at home waiting for, you know, their children to be looked after so that they can actually go out and find work.
Villafan Perez is the mother of a high schooler, a middle schooler, and a third grader. Two of her three children are immersed in distance education, while her youngest has just returned to hybrid school. What does it look like for her to strike a balance with so many demands in two separate counties?
There are many gaps in between. My son in particular has started middle school this year on Zoom and is struggling. I don't have the time or the resources often to help. We don't have that kind of, you know, income flow to just hire a tutor or go off to our lake house in Tahoe and, you know, change the scenery. It's an ongoing challenge. On some days I leave work early to be able to come and pick up my kid, to take her to class and to pick her up. But, you know, I have that flexibility, and I can't imagine those families that don't.
But Villafan Perez says none of this is new to moms around the world.
I have been home with my kids for that March through July time. I was home with them the entirety of that time and trying to get my own work done. But, you know, there's a pile of laundry over there, so that has to get done. They have to be fed. They have to, someone has to follow up on homework, and that all falls on mom.
Amidst the struggle, Villafan Perez says she's finding some silver lining.
I've learned that I can do more than I thought I ever could, that I can juggle, I can multitask. I've enjoyed spending the time with my kids at home. I've always been a working mom ever since they were itty bitty, and so I've learned to absolutely cherish that time with them.
That's Lorena Villafan Perez speaking about her roles as a family advocate and caretaker in pandemic times. It's been over a year since the COVID-19 pandemic began, causing an uptick in Americans reporting anxiety and depression. Many children have been out of school since last March, causing many of them to feel isolated, especially those facing mental health challenges.
My name is Stella. I'm 9 years old.
I'm SB. I'm 9 years old.
My name is Claire, and I'm 11 years old.
Although these children have never met in person, they found each other through the Origami Story Club, a group meant to support children impacted by BFRBs, or body-focused repetitive behaviors.
My BFRB is that I pick my eyelashes, and I do it a lot. And sometimes it's just that I want my hands to stop, but they just don't stop, and I just feel like my hands betray me sometimes. But doing origami with other people that have BFRBs just reminds me that I'm not alone.
My BFRB is picking my lip. Usually when I'm picking on myself, I do it mostly during the day, so that's when I have time to fold paper, and it kind of helps me from picking.
I have trichotillomania that started in June during the pandemic. I have been doing origami since the fall, and it's really fun. Everyone is really nice, and we all have something in common.
Jen Patterson is the founder of Origami Story Club.
I love origami, and I love teaching origami. I wanted it to be really fun and really playful and really just about connecting.
Patterson says when the pandemic struck, she pivoted her story club to a Zoom model, making it possible to bring kids from across the country and even Canada together virtually.
I give them the chance actually right away with the first club to share if they struggle with skin picking or hair pulling. And then there's always the option to pass. And some kids will. They don't want to talk about it. And other kids are like so excited to meet other kids who have that same challenge. So yeah, we read a story together and then we fold something out of origami. I think origami is, for me, it's the perfect activity because we're keeping our hands busy, but it's also kind of frustrating. And so it gives a lot of opportunity for us as a community, you know, within that group to talk about, like, what are we going to do if we get frustrated, or what's going to happen if I don't know how to fold this, and sort of building up that ability to reach out for support. And then my hope is the kids get to have mastery.
Statistically speaking, a little more than 5% of the population struggles with BFRBs, or body-focused repetitive behaviors, which translates to about one child per classroom.
My hope is to connect with kids so that they can not have that long experience of feeling, you know, like they can't talk about it, or like it's so private that they can't seek support.
Since many children impacted by BFRBs already feel isolated, Patterson says it's especially important to bring these children together during pandemic times.
My general experience is these kids and adults are really sensitive people. Sensitive in the best sense, you know, people who are really kind, really thoughtful, really observing. It's like a superpower and a kryptonite. And I wouldn't want to get rid of that sensitivity that I have. But boy, it takes a lot. And I think a lot of skills and a lot of support to navigate that, you know, to make it a strength. And yeah, the pandemic for so many people, it's just created so much isolation, so much time to think instead of just doing, you know, it's like sitting around thinking is not the way to get through these disorders. It's really about action and about, you know, movement. And so I think especially for kids, you know, who aren't getting those chances to go out and run on the playground with their friends and burn that energy, I think it seems extra hard.
If you know someone with a BFRB, Patterson says unconditional acceptance and education are the key elements.
The more acceptance and kindness you can offer to someone with a body-focused repetitive behavior, the more it's going to be possible for them to change it. And it's a little counterintuitive, because I think sometimes we think, you know, stop that, like, don't do this, you know, I'm going to kind of step in and tell you what's right. And I think with these behaviors, that doesn't work. it just helps, you know, maybe help someone keep it more secret.
To learn more, you can visit origamistoryclub.com or bfrb.org. I'm Sharon Sabota, and you're listening to special International Women's Day programming on KPFA 94.1 FM and online at kpfa.org. We'll take a quick musical break with the help of my daughters Esperanza and Delilah, and we'll be back with the second half of the show for the segment called Silent No More.
Hi, I'm Espy.
And Delilah.
And we're going to be singing The Girl in the Mirror by Bebe Rexha. I'm tired, my thoughts, they weigh me down, feels like I'm drowning. I'm tired, my flaws, they fill me with anxiety. And I, honestly, I'm done with hating pictures of myself and trying to be like everybody else. I wanna be like, look like the girl in the mirror. Wanna act like, dance like, no one's watching her. I could try to be just like you, but I wanna be like me, the girl in the mirror.
I'm Sharon Sabota, and you're listening to special International Women's Day programming on KPFA 94.1 FM and online at kpfa.org.
Muriel Rukisir once rhetorically asked, what would happen if one woman told the truth about her life? The world would split open, she said. In this special segment, I'm going to share one of those truths with you. We all have our origin story about the life experiences that shaped us in some way, sending us on a detour or leading us to a path far different than the one we might have imagined. One of those experiences for me happened when I became a secondary survivor after attending a college party with my friend who was separated from me for hours until I found her locked in a bedroom, naked and in a limp state, where she'd been vomiting while lying on her back. I remember suggesting that we should call 911 for help and being talked out of that by people at the party who said not to worry because this kind of thing happened all the time. It took four men and me to get my friend's clothes back on her body and carry her down a flight of stairs. I stayed next to her that night, propping her onto her side so she wouldn't vomit and choke. And I left in the morning when the sun finally started coming out. Turned out my friend had no memory of anything that had happened to her. I went with her to the women's center, and we became subjects in a college rape investigation. I remember getting calls from the roommate of my friend and from acquaintances advising me to keep my mouth shut unless I wanted to be responsible for ruining my friend's assailant's reputation. And so began my life path as an advocate, a journalist seeking to amplify voices that had otherwise been silenced, and a storyteller. This particular story that I'm going to tell you today is the story of another woman, who I'll call June, because she's asked that I not use her actual name. It's an unfortunate coming-of-age story from the rural town of Whitehall, Wisconsin. It happened more than two decades ago, and the woman, who is now a single mother of four, is still piecing her life back together.
There was a night in July of 1996, it was July 26, 1996 to be exact. My mother and her then boyfriend got into an argument. Something was thrown through the screen door, a stroller or something, and the neighbors called the police, and Dan Wineski showed up, who was the police officer on duty, and he told me I had to come make a statement, and I said I would just walk because I lived right next door to the police station. He said no, he would take me down there.
June got into Officer Wineski's vehicle, but she didn't end up at the police station.
Instead of going to the station, he went down to the other end of town by the A&W. And I said, this is not the police station. And he told me he was just making a quick trip through town to check on things. Instead of turning around, he went down. There's a little gravel road that'll take you past trees. And I think back there used to be the dog pound or something. He stopped on that little gravel road.
June says she knew she was in trouble.
I mean, when he stopped and parked, you know, I knew there was something that was wrong. I mean, just that sense with every fiber of my being that something was wrong. Plus, there'd been rumors as far back as I can remember about him and things that he had done to other girls and women. So that was playing in my head. And I said, no, I'm going to get out now. And he said, no, you're not. And I was in the passenger seat. And I kept looking down because it was his gun. You know, I could see it. And I didn't know what to do or how to even react. And do I try to open the door? Do I run? I mean, where do I run? He's the police. Who do I tell? What do I do? And I asked what was going on. And I was under the impression I was having to give a statement. And he just said I wasn't stupid and not to play stupid. And I knew what was going to happen, and I needed to do what was expected.
What happened next would haunt June for the rest of her life.
I could hear my heart in my ears. I was cold and shaking, but yet sweating. And then I could hear his zipper on his pants. And then he stopped, and I heard like this button and stuff like that. And I looked, and he set his gun down on the dash, and it was pointed right at me. Then he grabbed the back of my head and was pushing me down into his lap. And I just said, no, 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 I don't want to do this. I don't want to do this. Just stop. I won't tell anybody. Just let me go. I don't want to do this. I don't know what I'm doing. I was saying anything that could come out of my mouth.
Because you're 14 and he's trying to force you to perform oral sex.
Oral sex, yes. And I'm going to throw up, you know, anything I could think of. And he said very clearly and very matter of fact, as if he was just giving me driving instructions almost, but just do what you're told and be the good little whore that you know you are. And I had to start performing oral sex on him because I didn't know if he was going to shoot me or I didn't know what was going to happen. You know, I'll never forget any of that. The smell, I to this day cannot smell Tide laundry detergent because that's what I could smell, was that smell. I didn't know it was Tide laundry detergent till after this had all happened and I smelt it again, and it was a very strong reaction. You know, the feeling of it in my mouth, I mean, it was awful, and I just wanted it to be over. And he kept pushing my head down further and further, and I couldn't breathe. And then the radio went off and someone was talking on the radio. It was a call of some kind. And he just pulled me up really fast and told me to get out and, you know, not to tell anybody or he would kill me. I opened the door as fast as I possibly could and fell. I just fell out. And I know my leg was burning, but I just got up and I ran. And I didn't even realize how far I had ran, but I don't know where I was going, but I didn't end up at home. I ran all the way to the other side of town past the laundromat. And I collapsed. It was like a puddle. I don't know how long I laid there. I just was watching the clouds and everything seemed very surreal, almost like it was a dream. I can remember thinking, thank God that call came in. And at the very same time I thought that, I felt guilty because I was thankful that someone needed help, you know, that someone else was in danger or in peril. And because of their situation, it saved me.
June eventually made her way back home, but even home didn't feel like a safe place to land.
I could see the broken screen door, and it was all like instantaneous again, because it was like that was the reason. You know, I was angry, but yet scared and everything. It just so many different emotions at one time. And I couldn't go tell my mom what happened. I didn't want to bring, I don't know. I don't know if shame isn't the right word, but I believed a lot of that, you know, dirty whore. And, you know, I was from the wrong side of the tracks. And so that was ringing in the back of my head.
Soon he came back to her home again to respond to another domestic disturbance between her mom and stepdad.
There was another fight at my house and the cops got called because my mom and stepdad were drunk and fighting and the neighbors got called. And this time I think it was a small TV. Everything always went through our screen door. It was just kind of like we stopped fixing it because it just kept getting broken. And Wineski showed up. And he said, well, you're going to have to come make a statement. And I said, oh, no, I'm not falling for that again. I said, if you're telling me I have to, I will walk over there and I will go into the police station and do it. I'm not going with you, because I didn't know if I had the right to say no. Like, he was making it sound like I would be arrested or I would be in some kind of serious trouble. And so I did. And I went over there and asked me a couple of questions about it. And he again had his weapon, but he put it on the table and he said that he would put that inside of me and pull the trigger if I ever pulled that again.
And then seemingly showed up wherever she was.
I skipped school with a bunch of friends and he caught us going to my house. And you know, they're supposed to take you back to school. He didn't. He sat there and winked at us and said, okay, girls, go in there and have your nice little quiet party. And I won't tell anybody that I saw you. And, you know, I would just glare at him because I knew why he was being that way. And there was another time that I was literally outside my house and he was parked in the big parking lot right there in the squad car. And he told me to go over there. He called my name and I walked over there. And he said, you're supposed to be in your house. It's past curfew. And I said, I'm in my front yard. You know, I'm not breaking curfew. And he smacked me across the face.
Without a template for healthy relationships, June found herself in a cycle of abusive relationships. And when something happened between June and her then boyfriend, Officer Wineski was there to respond.
Dan Wineski pulled us over and he could see that I was upset. I'm sure he could see that, you know, my face was messed up. And he goes, well, you have two choices. Do you want to stay with him or do you want to come with me? I basically had to choose between one hell or the other. And at least with JJ, I thought I had a fighting chance.
June has her suspicions about why the officer chose her.
He had had interactions with me in the past from running away from home or my mom calling because we were arguing and I was refusing to listen. You know, I was very angry as a youth.
June's mother was 18 when she had her, and she had fled an abusive marriage to move to this tiny town in the middle of Wisconsin for a fresh start.
My mom was a single mom for pretty much my whole life. My dad and her got divorced when I was two. She did the best she could with what she had, and she was a bartender. You know, that's what she always did, but she was an alcoholic. And then her boyfriend, who she had the fight with that night, is now my stepfather. You don't know how to deal with being a teenager anyways when you're a teenager. And then you add all the messed up home stuff. And it made me very angry to where I would kind of just do what I wanted to do. My mom would ground me, but I would still leave. You know, so he had interactions with me.
Your mom had called him to help with family issues?
He was always the hero. My mom thought that he was one of the good guys because he didn't make her feel like she was worthless or put her down like a lot of people in that town had. And my mom by no means was a villain in this story. She just was a kid, you know, raising a kid. And she didn't have a support system. And he knew that.
June says she had to grow up fast.
Sometimes I felt like I was the mom.
June was almost 14 when her mom gave birth to June's younger sister.
And then she had my little sister, who I love dearly, but I took on the responsibility of taking care of her pretty much full time.
And in the meantime, you're a teenager who's struggling and not feeling great yourself.
Yes. Yep. But, you know, she became my world, and I would go to school and pick her up from the babysitters. And a lot of times I would be taking care of her all night because my parents didn't come home, or it was tough. But her and I have a very strong relationship because of that.
June says her family is an example of how intergenerational cycles of struggle and violence can be.
My grandmother is also an alcoholic. So was her real father. And then her stepfather is an alcoholic. So there was always alcohol. And I think there was a lot of kids parenting themselves. I love my grandmother to death, but, you know, they weren't hands-on or necessarily the best at raising kids. You know, and obviously you repeat what you know, you know, until you can break the cycle or figure out how to do that. And I did that. And I didn't know I was doing that.
By 16, June was pregnant with her own first child. It was then that she mustered up the courage to speak to the chief of police about what Officer Wineski had done to her.
I seen him at his vehicle, not his cop car, but just his personal vehicle. And I walked over to him and I said, I really need to talk to you about something. And that was all I said. And I swear, without missing a beat, he goes, does it have to do with Wineski? And so I was like, yeah. And he goes, okay. He's like, well, I'm not on duty right now, so I officially can't take your statement. But when I come on duty, I'm going to come talk to you and we'll get this worked out.
But that's not what happened.
A couple hours later, I was home and we had like a front screened-in porch area and someone was knocking on the door and I opened it and it was Wineski. And he was not happy. Wineski informed me that nobody would be by to take my statement because there was nothing to take a statement on. And I needed to stop making up little high school girl stories. And he took his gun out and made me hold it under my chin. You know, I stood there terrified. You know, I didn't like guns. And I can remember it was like the heaviest thing it felt like it weighed 1,000 pounds. And I was so terrified because I was shaking. And I thought, if I even breathe wrong, this is going to go off. You know, I had no idea. And he just told me to remember how that felt. And you wouldn't want to find your sister decapitated on your front steps.
So you're in this vulnerable place and then you're assaulted by a police officer and your words don't matter if that's what message you're given. So how does that kind of set you up for the future in the way that you use your voice or don't use your voice?
I always, if it would get sexual, I felt like I would have to say yes. So I kind of just didn't even look to date or anything because I didn't know how to say no. I didn't know how to just back away from that situation. The other way is, I felt like being vulnerable would be used against me and that would open me up to be hurt again. So I always have this huge, tough exterior and I'm always working on everybody else because then I don't have to acknowledge, you know, what's going on within me. I have felt pretty much my whole life that what's going on inside of me doesn't matter because I didn't have the stability. I didn't have the safe zone. You know, I didn't know where that was.
Still a kid herself, June embarked on her own journey of motherhood at 16, never again speaking about what the Whitehall officer had done to her.
Until years later, when a federal investigator showed up at her door in La Crosse, Wisconsin. It turned out that many other women had begun speaking about their interactions with the officer, but the name that kept coming up over and over was June's.
My name was everywhere. So it was obvious that my neighbors and the community knew that he had a fixation on me and that I had been a victim in some way, shape, or form, whether it was stalking or harassment. My name just kept coming up. And I had no idea because I felt all alone because I guess in my mind, and even then, I thought somebody would help, if somebody would step up and do what's right, but nobody did.
It turned out that while June suffered alone, it wasn't because people didn't know.
There was so many people in Whitehall that had the ability and the power to change it, to stop it, to prevent some of it, and nobody did anything. And from what I can see, it hasn't really changed.
Well, other women who'd been victimized by the Whitehall police officer had come forward. June's case was the one that fell inside the statute of limitations.
Officer Wonesky ultimately was charged.
He was facing 33 years, and then he took what they call is an Alford plea. It's a way of pleading guilty without admitting your guilt.
June returned to Whitehall for the officer's sentencing hearing.
I went, my counselor came, my midwife came, my mom was there. The courtroom was packed. A couple of the other victims were there. They didn't get to speak, and I knew who they were, but, you know, they were there. I walked in, and Larry Estenson actually smiled and got up and tried to talk to me, and how are you doing? And it was almost like an out-of-body experience.
I'm Sharon Sabota, and you're listening to Silent No More, a special program for International Women's Day on KPFA 94.1 FM and online at kpfa.org.
Cynthia Ganote is a gender sociologist. I asked her to speculate about why so many people in the town were willing to be passive bystanders rather than facing the truth.
I think it makes people feel they can control the circumstances. Oh, well, that was her. She was fill in the blank instead of, let's be frank, it could happen to anyone.
And Ganote says, for some, it can be easier or more comfortable to accept the simple narrative that he, the officer, is a nice guy, and she, the victim, has a reputation.
So many people individualize situations. I think that's our mainstream go-to. Someone experiences poverty and people go to, what did that person do wrong? Where are they to blame? Where are they at fault? As a sociologist, I really like to take the lens away from the individual for a moment and say, what are the cycles in which that person has been immersed? What was that child born into? Was it a cycle of intergenerational poverty? Was that person born into a situation where gender-based abuse has happened? When you use that structural lens, you begin to ask, how did this happen? How did an officer of the law, who's seen as a quote unquote nice guy by everyone, how was that a serial predator who in fact had access to underage girls on a regular basis? And how did this town, how did this operate? And how did any complicity with fellow officers or anyone else, how did this system work that allowed this man to be a serial predator and to deeply damage the lives of young girl after young girl?
This, Ganote says, leads to internalized oppression, which leads to silence and continues the cycle of violence.
Patriarchy itself is the backdrop here. Then you have a young woman who, from this age of 14, is coerced into a sexual act by an authority figure who has been presented to her as a quote-unquote nice guy by people in the town and by her own mother, who, all of whom saw him as such because he presented as such. In fact, having this kind of predator come at an early age and violate her sexually and her boundaries and her sense of what an authority figure does, it makes a lot of sense that a number of women in that situation then have further traumatic relationships with men in their path.
Sometimes, Ganote says, blaming the victim can feel safer than facing the reality that it could happen to any one of us, even you.
You end up in the truly frightening realization that is absolutely accurate. It could happen to you. It could happen to your child. It could happen to your niece or nephew. It could happen to anyone when the system supports predators like this continuing rather than having systems of accountability, not just for officers, yes, for officers, for everyone.
Well, June was relieved that the officer was sentenced to several years in prison. There was too much turmoil in her own life and in her situation with her ex-husband for her to feel safe.
My ex-husband knows how to talk, knows what to say, how to make you feel like you're the most amazing, special, only person on the face of the earth, and then turn it around some way without you even realizing it. I didn't see it happening, getting so far into my head that I had no idea who I was anymore. I mean, the lure to that was he made me feel special. He made me feel like he was listening to me, like I mattered. He didn't know about the Winneski stuff or anything like that, but I would tell him things about my past relationship or my mom and things like that. And he'd be like, oh my God, I'm so sorry. Things are going to be so different. I'm going to take care of you. And warning signs, what it should have been, was A, he was already married and trying to woo me. You know, hello, red flag. He told me I have not had sex with my ex-wife in many months. We're separated. Well, then her and I ended up having a baby 3 months apart. So clearly that was false, you know, but he always had a way to make me feel sorry for him. Like he was the victim. And I can tell you right now, one of the most vivid memories I have is one of the times I caught him cheating. I actually, after we were done having the conversation, was sitting in our living room sobbing and apologizing to him for him cheating on me. He was like, it's okay. I know you didn't mean it.
By 2012, it was clear to June that her now ex-husband was not the protector he'd once made himself out to be.
When Winneski got off of supervision completely in 2012, my ex-husband would tell me almost daily, I'm going to tell him where he lives. I'm going to tell him where you live. I'm going to watch when he shows up. And I'd be like, we have kids. You know, what are you talking about? And he didn't care. And so I made the decision to take my kids and I was going to run to Canada because Winneski couldn't get me in Canada. My husband probably wouldn't care enough to try to find me there. He would just move on to another girl. And I was going to flee. I didn't know how I was going to do that. I wasn't allowed to work. I wasn't allowed to have money. My ex-husband controlled all of that. I didn't have any identity outside of him. But I knew I wasn't going to let my kids be harmed.
Feeling like she had no other option, she wrote bad checks to get cash, hoping she could get a fresh start. But her plan backfired.
I opened a checking account and I wrote a bunch of bad checks off my own account. And I would buy things and sell them. And I was hoarding the cash because I needed money, right? And I was keeping a list of where I'd written these checks because I was going to find a way to make it right. I was going to pay these checks back. But right now, I needed to get my kids out of there. I had to get out of there. The logical part of my brain, which is there, was not kicking in saying, whoa, caution, this is dumb, this isn't going to work. Well, it didn't work. I got arrested. They took all the money and they kept it. And I still don't know exactly where that goes. And it never got applied to the restitution because I had to pay all that back. But it did get me away from my ex-husband.
Now, June's name carries the felon asterisk behind it, making it hard for her to secure employment or follow her dream of being an advocate for other women experiencing trauma.
It haunts me. I mean, I had to quit school because I was in nursing school and they said they couldn't put me anywhere to do my clinicals because of my criminal record. I haven't been able to find good jobs. I had somebody at an employment agency look me straight in my eye and tell me if I was a sex offender, I'd have a better chance of getting employed than money crimes. Because nobody cares about the reasoning, you know? And I haven't been in trouble since, but it follows me around and that's all directly related. And that's when I decided I can't keep being a victim, you know? And that's why I knew I wanted to write. I knew I wanted to tell my story. I want people to know that this stuff happens and it happens a lot more than what I even know.
June says her own situation makes it impossible for her not to be critical of the officers in George Floyd's case.
It angers me. I've seen so many people post about George Floyd and his criminal past and his past doings. Was he an angel? Absolutely not. But he did not deserve to be murdered. I don't care what he did. You know, they murdered him in front of the entire world and nobody did anything. And I've also seen a lot of people say, well, those bystanders didn't do anything. I can understand that and I appreciate that, but I can also understand why they wouldn't. There's that fear of the police and then you want to believe like this isn't going to end that way. You know, I think it's just a safety mechanism for our minds to try to come to the best conclusion so that way we don't realize how terrifying things can be.
How do you feel about the other police being held accountable? And
that's different. They're not just bystanders. You know, their job and their oath is to help serve and protect. And they didn't do any of that. Now, a couple of them were new or fairly new or whatever. I don't care. You know, they still knew right from wrong. There was no reason they couldn't have tapped him out, so to speak, and be like, I've got it from here, go cool down or whatever. You know, if all three of those officers would have done the right thing, we would have had a different outcome. People are going on stereotypes, and it's just, it's not okay. And the police think they can do it. You know, you think the Band of Brothers is strong in a huge police force. In a police force of like five people, it's Teflon, nothing sticks. I mean, the things that I read and the when this was all going on and the stuff that he did for 25 years, Dan Oneski, everybody knew.
June says she had to learn to care for herself before she could care for others.
I was taking care of my mom. I was taking care of my sister, you know, and then I was having babies. You know, by the time I was barely 22, I had three kids. And I've just always been taking care of everybody else, which I used, I guess, as a distraction. But it's been very detrimental because failing to take care of myself, I've actually failed others, you know, my children, you know, trying to protect them, but I was protecting them in the wrong way, you know, or trying to get them to forget about stuff. I would just go out and buy them things that they didn't need because, you know, I just didn't want them to think about the bad stuff. I did not set good examples for relationships with them. And I tried to protect my kids. I was determined, right? Remember I said that I was going to give them. I had the same cycle of crap, that only in a different way. I didn't drink, you know, I don't do drugs, but they witnessed abuse. They were abused mostly emotionally and mentally, but some physically by my ex-husband. And I see the stuff that their dad pulls and how he manipulates them. And it kills me to no end. And I will bear that cross forever, probably. I don't know if I'll ever fully forgive myself because I did not break that cycle.
June says splitting up with her husband meant that she had to figure out who she was.
I can guarantee you if we were to talk to 100 women who have been abused or assaulted or whatever, and they've lived this, especially for a long period of time, they have no sense of identity. They have no sense of self. I didn't even know what kind of eggs I liked after I left my husband because I had always done everything his way. I am a chameleon. I mean, even in friendships, I would become the person that I thought they wanted me to be. I was never really me.
Since the interview, June and the father of her youngest child split, and she landed a job back in the same small place where she was once a victim. With lots of hard work and the support of a therapist, June says she has transitioned from a victim to a survivor. While June still faces some of the residual emotional trauma she has endured and knows the familiar struggle that many single moms face of making ends meet, she has high hopes for the future.
If I can help other people find their voice and I can help other people feel strong, then I will continue to get my strength and I will continue to have my voice. And that can't be taken from me anymore. And that can't be silenced anymore.
I'm Sharon Sabota, and it has been a pleasure to be with you on this International Women's Day Eve. Be sure to tune in to the third Sunday of the month for more stories highlighting women's voices. Before I sign off, a special shout out to my own daughters, Esperanza and Delilah, for helping with the musical break, and to my niece, Ella, who's turning 8 on International Women's Day. And a shout out to all of you for tuning in for this special programming. I want to wish you all a happy International Women's Day. You're listening to KPFA 94.1 FM and online at kpfa.org. Stay tuned now for more International Women's Day programming.